MD, OBGYN, MPH, and Accepted Consultant Talks Admissions. Welcome to the 214th episode of Admission Straight Talk, Accepted's podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are stand out in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in!" And not only in, but in at the best program for you. Our guest today is Dr. Susie Schweikert, a former English major at UCLA who decided she wanted to be an MD. She did so at UCSD, specialized in OBGYN at USC Los Angeles County Medical Center, and after completing her residency, added an MPH to her credentials. Let's learn about Dr. Schweikert's path in medicine and to becoming an accepted consultant. Susie, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thanks, Linda. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Now, can you tell us a little bit about how you went from being an English major to applying to medical school?
Sure. It is a bit of a long story. I'll start in my first year of college when I got a C- in chemistry.
Ouch.
And I gave up being a pre-med. I thought I was done for. And the next year I retook it and I got a B- and I gave up again. I really didn't have any doctors or nurses in my family. I had no idea of what it took to get there. And after 2 years of just bumbling around and not knowing what to do, I transferred to UCLA, and they only had room for me as an English major. So that's what I became.
Really?
And it turned out to be the best decision for me because I did well. It boosted my GPA. It gave me a nice break from science classes. I really loved studying for a biochem final one day and then switching gears to write an English paper. And it also gave me it's kind of a special expertise because all of my pre-med friends who found out I was an English major asked me to read their essays. And a lot of them, my peers at the time, were non-native English speakers, and they were very stressed by the writing process, and they knew they needed another pair of eyes. And I really think that reading all those essays helped me know how to best write my own. So eventually I became a pre-med again, and I did fine. I did great in my science classes. And even though I was a little bit intimidated when I first got to medical school, surrounded by all those molecular bio majors, I discovered that I could just do as well as anybody else. So ultimately, I think that you should major in any subject that you enjoy as long as you do well in it and you figure out what your learning style is and how you can study effectively.
Now, did you have to take like a post-bac program or do an informal post-bac yourself in order to get into
medical? I continued my undergraduate training for 6 years, so I sort of did a post-bac within my undergraduate year. So I do think post-bacs are great. I think so many students don't do well in the first couple of years just because they don't know their own learning style, and when they do the post-bac, they figure it out.
So you kind of took the long route through undergraduate?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, I was a non-traditional student, being a transfer student, being an English major, doing my pre-med later in college, but it all kind of worked out.
It all worked out, for sure. And how did you adjust your learning style? Like, I mean, I took a lot of English classes in undergrad. I was not an English major. So how did your learning style have to change to master the sciences? What are some of the differences?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, so the trick was just finding out what works for you in terms of test preparation. And I found that just because your friends study one way doesn't mean that's going to work for you, so you have to experiment. I found that I learned best by writing and rewriting my notes over and over and using multiple colors. And so usually I would end up with 4 or 5 copies of my lecture notes, each set more colorful and more detailed. And by the 5th time that I wrote them down, I really understood the material. And I also memorized better when I was walking or moving around. So I quizzed myself as I walked around the block or up and down the stairs. And nowadays, you might say that I'm a kinesthetic or a graphic learner, but at the time, I just knew that if I read or heard something 20 times, I still would not be able to completely understand it. It wasn't until I wrote it down that I fully understood the concept. And this actually helped me with my MCATs, too.
I'm supposed to interview in a few weeks. I don't remember the exact date. somebody who's just starting his residency program, and he's also an artist and cartoonist. And he found that he learned best by drawing.
Right. I think sometimes that the way to get something deep into your brain is to do an activity that just comes very naturally to you, whatever that is.
Yeah. Yeah. And his drawings are amazing. I can't draw worth being, so anybody who can go beyond stick figures to me is, you know, another Michelangelo. But he might be more like Leonardo. But anyways, it's the same concept. In other words, you figure out what learns best for you and what works best for you and the way you learn best, and then you pursue that method.
Exactly.
And you went on from medical school, and how did you decide to become an OBGYN?
So that was another long, drawn-out thing. I had originally or always thought I wanted to go into family practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually even applied to family practice residencies. And then I did a sub-internship in ICU medicine, and I said to myself that I really enjoyed being in critical care situations. So I did another sub-internship in OBGYN, and by the end of that, I came home and I withdrew my family practice applications and applied to OB. So I think doing a sub I really does give you a sense of what is out there. When you're doing your third year rotations in medical school, a lot of times you don't get exposed to specialties very well, or you might be in a team with residents and interns who are very stressed out, and you just don't enjoy the experience as you could. So I think that going and doing the sub-I, it gives you an entirely new look at the specialty, gives you a sense of what an intern, the responsibilities of an intern, how other hospitals treat their residents. In my OB sub-I, I was delivering babies on my own, and I even did a C-section on my last day. So that really clinched it for me. I knew that's what I wanted to do.
And how about the decision to pursue an MPH? Why?
So, yeah, after residency, I spent a few years in private practice, but I missed working with the underserved patients that I had cared for in medical school and residency, and I missed the academic world of questioning and learning. So I figured that I had two choices. I could apply for a fellowship in a subspecialty, like perinatal medicine or oncology, or I could pursue an MPH. And really, the MPH was the best fit for my personal sense of purpose. I'd always wanted to make a difference for those people who fell through the cracks. As an undergrad, I'd volunteered in a homeless clinic, and that was a big part of my motivation to go back to my pre-med studies. Mm-hmm. So private practice had just not been fulfilling my personal mission, and studying public health gave me a pathway back to that original passion. And I ended up working in a community clinic setting where I still work today. So,
wow. Okay.
Good choice.
All right. Now, when you were on the UCSD admissions committee and reviewing applications, I assume that's when you were a student there, what surprised you about the students being admitted? Did anything surprise you? Or did it all just kind of fit with what you anticipated as a student applicant?
You know, I was always surprised every year by how incredibly nice they were, the people who were admitted. I knew that the admissions committee wasn't just looking for the smartest and the most accomplished applicants. But they also, you know, told me that they were looking for people they could imagine caring for your own parent, your own child.
Mm-hmm.
They would ask themselves, what will this person be like in a crisis under stress? And I think, you know, the quality they were really often looking for and which they found was kindness.
Right.
And although I think kindness is a really hard quality to prove, I think it shows in the way people talk about themselves, how they behave towards others on interview day. So that always surprised me. I did not think all the medical students would be just really genuinely nice people, but they were.
It reminds me, as you know, sometimes when Accepted hosts a webinar, I invite some consultants to participate in the Q&A. And one individual in the webinar, an applicant, asked, and Dr. Herman Gordon was one of the consultants answering questions. And so one of the applicants said that he has a friend who had, you know, a 3.9 and a 5.18 and, you know, research and all this stuff. And he said, why would this guy have gotten rejected? Now, I suspect he was talking about himself, but whatever, he was his friend. And Dr. Gordon just said, the jerk factor.
Yeah. Yeah. The people catch on to that. And, you know, I think that, you know, even sometimes if it's just out of, acting out of insecurity, if you're not behaving respectfully and nicely to people on interview day, yeah, whether it's the receptionist or the shuttle bus driver, you know, people are going to notice that. So it's important to get your nerves in check and behave as nice as you possibly can.
I think there's two aspects to that. First of all, by the way, this is across all applicant categories. If you are rude to the janitor at a school that you're visiting, you are toast. You have just killed your application chances.
I totally agree. And another thing I noticed that on interview days, there are a lot of applicants in the same room. And if you are one, if you act very aloof and disinterested in meeting and talking to the other applicants, that can work against you too. So trying not to feel so much in competition with them, but imagine them as these are your future colleagues. These people, you might end up in a residency together or in a fellowship together someday. So treating them well as well, even though they're your competition, you can learn a lot from each other.
That's right.
And after interview days, you can exchange emails and share stories of interviews, and these people can actually become your support.
And another point, if some of you are thinking, well, I was under tremendous pressure, I was super nervous, that's not really an excuse in the medical school context, because the pressure you're going to be under when somebody is terribly, terribly sick and you're supposed to be taking care of them is going to be far greater than the pressure you're under when you're walking into an interview room.
Exactly. Yeah. A big part of the interview, although in my school, we didn't do stress interviews where we put people under especially stressful situations. They do want to see how you're going to behave under stress, and they know it's a stressful day, and they take that into consideration of how you're going to behave in the hospital in a stressful situation. So yeah, it's very relevant.
Right. Right.
I think practicing your interviews in advance is a really, really important thing to consider.
Right. And that's absolutely anything that will reduce your stress, but stress should not trigger a lack of courtesy if you want to be a successful applicant and doctor. What other mistakes did you see applicants making in the application process?
Well, I think the biggest one was just acting overconfident. I think med schools are always on the lookout for those know-it-all kind of students who can't be taught anything. They really don't expect you to know much about medicine, and maybe just a small slice from whatever shadowing or volunteering you did. But if you start talking about things that you don't know much about, they will catch on, and they'll see right through it. So admissions committees really want people who say, "I know I have a lot to learn. Please teach me." So they don't want you to act super smart and show off your knowledge. That's going to work against you.
Okay, a little humility perhaps would be a good thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. For those now planning to apply to residency programs and starting to think about their personal statements for residency programs, what are critical differences between the residency personal statement and the medical school personal statement?
Well, you know, the residency statement builds on the last 4 years of medical school, but it's still about who you are at your core. So while you'll have some amazing experiences to write about, they still want to know what makes you tick. And now more than ever, I think it's the time to really dig deep and tell them who you are. And another thing to think about is how each residency program is so different in what they are looking for and what kind of environment they provide. And while you might be a great fit at one program, you're not going to be a good fit for another. So it's really best to be honest in your essay because you don't want to end up at a program that's the wrong place for you. So I do think that talking about yourself in a kind of a deep way, talking about some of your mistakes, your struggles, and your challenges, just like in the medical school application, is where you want to focus.
Now, when you talk about fit with programs, you're talking about fit with a specific specialty, like pathology versus family medicine, to choose two that are very, very, very different, or are you talking about specific?
Even within a specialty like OBGYN, Mm-hmm. Some programs are large and they are very busy and they want interns to jump right in and be very independent. Other programs are smaller and they're more like a tight-knit family, and they take you through a lot of training before you're on your own. So every program is really different, and just different ones fit different people's personalities and people's interests. So I definitely would go to a lot of residency interviews. Don't just choose one or two, but check them out and try to decide, do you want a large or a small residency? What kind of patient mix? Are you comfortable having fellows in your program, or would you rather be in a program without any fellows so you can do all the training and the cases yourself? And the ultimate thing, I think, when you go on interviews for residency is just to get your gut feeling about how happy the residents are. Do they seem like they're liking what they do and feeling well-trained, or are they acting kind of disgruntled and unhappy? So it's a real important sign to look for when you go.
Isn't one of the differences between a residency personal statement and a med school personal statement that the residency applicant is supposed to talk about what their motivation for that specific specialty? And they're not supposed to talk about why they want to be a doctor, because they already are a doctor.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that you do want to show why you want to go into that specialty and highlight some examples of cases you may have seen or been a part of. But you're still talking about yourself. It still has to be, kind of who you are, what makes you tick, mm-hmm. How you're going to deal with mistakes, how you're going to treat patients. So it's still sort of the same thing, but yes, much more focused on your specialty.
Okay. Do you have any advice? I mean, you mentioned the importance of rotations earlier, but do you have any additional advice for medical students trying to select a specialty?
I still think that doing the fourth-year sub-internships are one of the best ways. Mm-hmm. Because as a third-year student and a fourth, you just don't get a lot of exposure to some things. Talking with residents. So, when you do a sub-internship, you can talk with residents in different specialties, not just the one that you're in, and ask them why they like it and how it suits them. Plenty of people do a kind of a transitional internship, so they have another year after medical school to figure it out, to find out what suits them the best.
Right, right. That makes sense. Now, what advice do you have for those seeking to go into an OBGYN specialty specifically? What traits are critical in this specialty?
So one of the greatest things about being an OBGYN is that you get to be both a surgeon and a primary care doctor. So if you're having trouble choosing between these two areas, like I did, mm-hmm. OBGYN is really the only specialty where you can do both. The flip side is that it's also one of the hardest things about being an OBGYN, because you have more to learn, surgical and medical. And residencies really do look at your board scores to make sure that you're up to the task. They also rely pretty heavily on your letters of recommendation. So be sure that you get a strong one. And if you don't think you have a good letter, do a sub-internship and get one from that program director. Some of the traits that I think a lot of OBGYNs share are, first and foremost, they love teamwork. Things can get really slow on labor and delivery, and then all of a sudden 10 patients show up in active labor, and it's not that uncommon for residents on other rotations to come over to labor and delivery and help out. Having a willingness to pitch in when help is needed is really an important trait for your entire career. And the second trait, I think, is an ability to tolerate sleep deprivation. I think this is why many med students decide against it, and for good reason. Most specialties, you will experience some sleep loss and some stress from that, but it's especially intense in OB. And while OBs might grumble about being tired, they usually wake up quickly and love being there in an emergency. So they're kind of energized by that late night.
That's interesting.
I think the third, probably most important, is communication ability. So you can be very smart and know a lot, know your stuff, but if you cannot convey it to your patients in a short amount of time, it's not going to help. We often have to give patients a lot of information and help them make really big decisions in a short time, like having an emergency C-section. And you have to be comfortable explaining the procedure, the reasons, the genetic and anatomical issues, and many patients are really unfamiliar with this stuff. I've spent hours explaining prenatal genetic testing to folks who don't really know what DNA is. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to communicate in clear and, you know, suitable for the patient's, you know, level and language. You also have to be able to pass on your information to your colleagues efficiently and accurately. Most specialties realize that miscommunication is a huge source of error, and with the really fast pace of OBGYN, you have to be super careful to make sure you're telling your colleagues what they need to know so that they can make a decision. And I think the last trait you already mentioned, Linda, was humility. Just like in med school, OB residencies want people who are ready to learn and ready to learn from their mistakes and are willing to let their guard down and take risks and be humbled by the whole process.
It must also be just you are at countless births a day. Does it ever get old?
No, that part doesn't. you know, being an OBGYN has a lot more than just delivering babies.
Of course.
You know, a lot of primary care. There's a lot of patients with chronic pain. So it really is one of those specialties that crosses over into, you know, internal medicine, surgery. It's a very interesting specialty. You are much more like a detective, I think, sometimes. But delivering babies never gets old.
Okay. Slightly different experience that you now have, that is as an admissions consultant. How has advising applicants, so you've been a successful medical school applicant yourself, you were on the admissions committee, you've trained doctors, you've trained, obviously you've taught patients, you're an MPH, I believe you also served on the admissions committee for MPH or were training public health students. How has serving on this side of the table, advising applicants, change your perspective on the process?
Oh, yeah, good question. I remember how I felt, and I think most applicants feel, that they really have to sound and come across as perfect, you know, as this amazing person. But the truth is that I've kind of learned is that admissions committees are not looking for perfect. What they want to see, though, is some compassion, respect for others, mental toughness, and they want you to show examples of these in your lives. And that's really, to me, the big contradiction in medical school applications, is that on the one hand, you're trying to package yourself as this great student, and on the other hand, you have to show that you're not perfect and that you know it. And you can't really say it like that, so you have to show it with your experiences and the connections you make between your past and your growth as a human being. I really feel like being a doctor is about connecting to people in such a physical and emotional way and invading the human body with instruments and drugs, and your patients have to trust you. And to earn that trust, you really have to show an incredible amount of respect to people, and you have to know how, you know, people see you and how if you're acting respectfully to them or not. You have to be able to pick up on that and change your tactic if a patient isn't accepting what you say or is defensive. I think that what I've learned is that perfection is not the key. It's more self-awareness.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely something that's valued. What advice do you have for applicants planning to apply, not this cycle, but in the 2019 or later cycles?
Oh, they do, but I think it's so helpful to get started early. I think the best essays are the ones that take shape over several months. So I advise people, if they ask me early, to start journaling every day for 20 or 30 minutes. And, you know, knowing that you're not going to use most of what you wrote, but it will get you in the habit of self-reflection. I think it's hard to write a personal statement quickly because we're naturally guarded about revealing ourselves. And you have to write it down a little bit at a time, and eventually you'll start to see a theme. And I think you mentioned most applicants start out writing their personal statement, why they want to be a doctor, how they want to help people, and how they like science. And that's all fine, but it's not the theme of your essay because it doesn't differentiate you from anybody else. So I tell applicants, you get through a first draft, you'll read it over and think it's just a lot of words without any direction. But near the end, there's usually a sentence or two that rings true, and that's where your real essay begins. That's where they find their theme. You know, and the real question is really not why you want to be a doctor or how badly you want it. It's whether you're willing to give so much of yourself to others. And you can show them that by giving a lot of yourself in the personal statement.
It's a great way to look at it. I sometimes tell applicants to say, I want to be a doctor because I want to help people. You know, when my sink is clogged, the plumber comes and unplugs it, he's really helping me. So why don't you become a plumber? There's some relationship, there's some correlation, but, you know, that usually stops them for a moment. And obviously they have to think a little bit more about the answer to that question. But I think you've raised
I think you have to start with, I want to be a doctor, this is why, and you get to the deeper reasons as you write. So you really have to just, that's why getting started early is so beneficial.
And you mentioned journaling a little bit a minute ago. I mean, am I supposed to journal about what I had for breakfast in the morning or, I mean, what, if I were to start journaling, what would I be writing down?
Oh, good question. You know, I think you can go through sort of your past because, you know, you want to talk about real life experiences. So I would look at your list of experiences that you're planning to put on your essay and start writing about them and how they changed you, how they helped you grow, what you learned, what mistakes you made. And as you write about each one of those experiences, some will come be more clearly meaningful to you and will help you with your statement.
So you're talking about journaling really with a specific purpose. So you know, you can write a different activity description or most meaningful experience or even sections of your personal statement every day. And then you'll have, I guess, a treasure trove or a resource that you can draw on when it actually comes time to write the essay itself.
Exactly. And I think that that's an excellent way to feel like you're using your time wisely and not rushing to do it at the last minute. And again, a lot of what you write, you might not use, but it gets your brain sort of thinking about why you really want to do this. And I tell some applicants that you oftentimes at the end of writing your essay, you really know why you want to be a doctor. You've really learned it through the process of writing about it. It's a pretty powerful technique if you put the time into it.
And nobody really cares what you had for breakfast anyways.
Yeah, I forget already.
Right. What advice do you have for those, like in the thick of it right now? They're applying in the 2018 cycle. Maybe they already submitted their primary. I hope they did. Maybe they're about to submit it, or they're just starting on the primary, or they're starting to get secondaries. What advice would you have for them?
I would say do not waste precious space talking about what other people have done. It's your own actions that speak loudest, and you need to highlight your own experiences. And also don't waste space writing about the school itself. In your secondaries, there's a strong temptation, I think, to write about all these excellent programs that schools offer. And while I think it's okay to mention them, for the most part, they know about their own excellent programs. Mm-hmm. You really want to write about how you are going to fit into their school, and don't try to second guess what the school wants to hear. They like to be surprised. They like to admit different people and a variety of people. So they're not looking for a single cookie cutter kind of applicant. And lastly, remember that anything you write in your secondaries is fair game for your interview. The biggest mistake I made in my applications was writing about healthcare economics in a secondary essay for a school that I knew had a big emphasis on this. And when I was interviewed by a health economist, I talked myself in circles and eventually dug a hole that I never got out of. And although I wasn't at all surprised when I didn't get in, I learned from this mistake. And in later interviews, I learned to say, I don't know the answer to that, or I'd like to learn more about that. And I think that goes back to remembering that humility and just a general readiness to learn are really two most important things that medical schools are looking for.
Okay, thank you. What do you wish I would have asked you?
Yeah, you know, I think a stress reduction is such an overlooked thing for medical students.
I almost asked you about that. I really did.
Oh, really? Yeah. It's a hot topic these days, and there's more and more coming into medical schools. But when I was in med school, I took a stress reduction class, which I think was very cutting edge at the time. And it was really the best thing I ever did. We did finger painting and folk dancing and journaling and just all sorts of different things. And I realized that there are many ways to de-stress, and it's much better for your patients if you do it often. And it's also a good thing to teach your patients. So it's one of the most valuable things that I learned, and I'm still learning. I think, you know, you're always finding new ways to relieve stress, and whether it's exercise, nature, spending time with family or friends, music, dancing, whatever relaxes and recharges you is important to find out now. The medical school or residency application process can be so stressful, but it's not going to get better for a while. So, you know, learning how to just get your mind off of it, get away from it, I think is a super important skill.
Right. I mean, the practice of medicine is stressful. You're dealing with people's lives. They're bringing you their problems. They're making their problems your problems.
Right.
You have to know how to deal with it.
You do. And we're finding more and more connections between stress and chronic illness and inflammation. And, you know, stress is really going to be, I think, one of the most important things you learn how to deal with in medicine for yourself and your patient.
Okay. Susie, I think we're running out of time. Thank you so much for joining me for this podcast, number 214. And thanks for sharing your experience and perspective.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to work with Dr. Schweikert on your med school or residency applications, I'll link from the show notes at exhibit.com/214 to both Dr. Schweikert's Contact Me page and our service descriptions, as well as to other related resources and previous podcast episodes. Thank you for tuning in to this, our 214th episode. If you found this show worthwhile, please make sure you don't miss any others. Subscribe through your favorite podcatcher. We have subscribe links in the show notes at exhibit.com/214. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.